Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. The voters have spoken, folks. At least some of them, 20% of the registered Democrats in New Haven went to the polls yesterday for mayoral primary. And now a man who tells it like it is will tell us about what it all means. Our guest is the Reverend Samuel Ross Lee of Emmanuel Baptist Church, one of the leading voices in New Haven for social justice. He's in WNHH studio today to help us run down the results of Tuesday's Democratic Party primary in New Haven. Good morning, Reverend Ross Lee. So nice to see you.
Good morning, Paul. Good to be here.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Tired, but okay.
Were you involved in yesterday's mayoral primary between Tony Harp and Marcus Pacus?
I was not.
But you were watching. You've been paying attention because you write some great
I pay attention comments. to the articles that were written on your site, comments. Always interested in the comments. They're very interesting. Almost the most important part of the newspaper.
You're a great commenter, and you always put your name on them.
I put my name on it. Yeah, I do that as a What am I doing that as? Response to people who
hide.
Yeah,
but some of your ones are like crafted, like real pieces. I remember when the professor at Yale who died in the lockup, you wrote this incredible thing. We were reading out loud, our staff members, about the humanity of everyone involved and how that got lost in the discussion.
Yeah,
those are some great pieces.
Yeah, I think that happens quite often. We start balkanizing and you know, race, gender, whatever, sexuality, and forget about the commonality of who we are.
So Reverend Ross Lee, yesterday, as you know, Tony Harp faced a primary for Marcus Pacus. She's going for her third term as mayor, and she clobbered him. She won all 30 wards of the city. She beat him by a 3-1 margin, just about 75% to 25%. She got 5,788 votes to his 1,977. Were you surprised, and what do you think it means?
I think I'm a little surprised when I look at the numbers of people who voted. It's a shame. I'm not a registered Democrat, so I didn't vote in this primary. I don't vote in the primaries like that. I think the story is in the people who are uninterested in voting at all, you know, and why. Some would claim that because there are not a lot of alder persons running, whatever. Is that true?
There are 30 wards in the city, and only 3 wards had alder races. Now, in the wards that had them, it was more than twice as much a turnout.
Right.
At Celentano School, which had really the only real race, the really competitive race, and even that wasn't so close. They had a 45% turnout in Ward 19. And at Bella Vista, they had it, which always has higher votes anyway, but they had a 45% turnout where they had an alder race there.
Okay.
Because the weather was good.
Yeah, and you know, the alder race is important in terms of people turning out. So the turnout was very, very low. I think I was too quick to say to affirm your description of the situation that he clobbered her. Yeah, what did you say? 20% of the registered voters.
Although one could argue that when there's a challenger, his votes are going to come out. The question is, how much does the incumbent excite people? She clearly did not excite a lot of her people to come out. My take on the ground, Reverend, was that Unite Here wasn't out getting votes. They didn't have candidates at stake for all their races. They kind of are the biggest vote polling organization in the city. They got something like 18,000 votes, I believe, 21,000 for Daniel Malloy in the city. But they also concluded that the mayor was in no trouble.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of people who would have gotten votes out for the mayor who didn't work because they felt there was no chance she was going to lose. Like, even though we in the media made a point, at least the Independent, of writing as many articles as we could about Marcus Pacus, so that somebody challenging a mayor gets a chance to make his case.
Right.
They have the best read on the ground. Mm-hmm. And they said ain't happening. I mean, 30 out of 30 wards, that's pretty complete. They felt there wasn't a real organization developed by Marcus Pacus. Or rationale, I know, for Mayor DeStefano's take was, well, things aren't perfect, but taxes have stayed constant. Crime has gone down. People did not feel a compelling reason, and when they listened to Marcus Pacus, they felt some people, mostly what they heard was that he's upset he got fired.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that wasn't an animating rationale for going to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take?
Well, I think, first of all, it's kind of a shame that you have to have an organization or a group of people who get people to go to vote. People should just vote, you know, because they're part of the, and, you know, they're part of the process and they're part of the democratic reality. And perhaps the most important part, so they should just go vote regardless. Not suggest that, you know, oh, this will be taken care of and I don't need to be a part of it, you know, type thing. I also think that people should listen more closely to the issues as they are put out there, and not just sort of the big issues, if you will. You know, my taxes are fine, I'm going to stay with the mayor. My job is secure, I'm going to stay with the mayor. My family's job is secure. You know, the status quo is good for me right now. I'm going to stay with the mayor, or I'm going to stay with whomever, the incumbent, and not listen to and not engage in the conversations about those other issues that, if you add them up, might be more important.
And I felt when people did, we had a debate a week ago where people were very engaged. There were people who already cared about the race, but then some other people tuned in on Facebook. It was a pretty good, I thought both debates were a pretty good discussion about gentrification, housing, sanctuary cities.
Right.
I don't know if they played out more for one candidate than the other, but I heard from people who paid attention that these were interesting conversations. I'm wondering if what you're identifying is a malaise in American political system, but also whether people just didn't feel inspired. They didn't feel they heard. Like, a lot more people went to the polls for the last two competitive primaries in 2011 and 2013.
Mm-hmm.
There were candidates who, the reason they had more people out working partly or more coming to the polls is they felt they were more inspired by the people who were running. I don't think that either candidate inspired a whole lot of people yesterday.
I mean, you know, these are reasons why people act. Question is, should they be the reasons why they act or not? And I don't think they should be, quite frankly. I think that people should be involved in process. I think they should be listening. I think they should be engaging the conversations. I think they should be making credible decisions about what they're hearing, intelligent decisions about what they're hearing. I started engaging this campaign from the perspective that this guy is a protest candidate, if you will. He's angry. He got fired. And frankly, I would have fired him too. He's not just a government worker, government employee, or somebody employed by the government, like a teacher, or, you know, something like that. But he was on the team, is in the administration. And when you're on the team, you follow the instructions of the team leader. The team leader is depending on you to act in a way that is, they believe, in the best interest. They could be wrong, but they're the team leader and you decided to join the team. If you think they're wrong, you should leave the team, but you shouldn't act contrary when they are, particularly when they're out of town, to what, you know, you've tacitly, if not explicitly, agreed to. So I would have fired him too. And I wouldn't have even come back to New Haven to fire him. I would have called in and fired him, quite frankly. But as I began to engage the campaign more and more, I thought Marcus had some very credible arguments. You know, you look at the comparison between whether he was fired or the police chief was fired.
Dean Esterman, who was pushed out but not fired.
Right.
That process lasted
right,
exactly, for months.
Pushed out but not fired. Superintendent of schools.
Right, pushed out, not fired.
Again, you know, so in roles that were much more important and much more impactful on the lives of people than his was, those people were not let go. You know, I don't know if he had enough time, or probably didn't have enough time, but, you know, the situation with the company, leaving town?
Alexion.
You know, after getting the money, you know, is that some sort of pattern of reality and behavior and that sort of thing? Particularly since the mayor is touting this as, you know, her great economic development in the city and that sort of thing. I think he raised some credible arguments, and he should be listened to more closely than But it also kind of, you know, I'm not going to say kind of, to me it's kind of makes sense, but it makes sense for people to want to protect their present reality and not have it thrown into flux.
Well, they have to believe that if they're going to make the change, they're making the change for someone who's better equipped to run the city.
Well, I'm not so sure that that's a question for a lot of people. I think it's, are they in the best positions to help me? I think people are very individualistic and to some degree narcissistic. You know, if this guy gets in office, am I going to keep my job? Am I going to keep my position? Is my husband or my whomever, cousins or whatever, going to keep their positions? So it, you know, self-preservation type, you know, situation. But because they didn't feel that he was a real threat in any way, they just said, you know, just let it play out and he'll be gone. I think the fact that her numbers was much bigger than his, you know, still belied the fact that very few people voted who could have voted. And that's kind of, I think, the tragedy of the whole situation.
We know some people, I'm guessing you're one of them, who feel like you're just supposed to vote. That you're always supposed to go to vote. That's your duty as a citizen. That's part of your responsibility in democracy. And I know a subset of people who go to every election and kind of ask me sometimes, I haven't paid attention, who are these people? I feel I have to vote and make some kind of decision.
Right.
That's not the majority.
Well, for me, I guess it's misleading to say, or, you know, I'll just say misleading, to say just go vote. When I say that, I'm saying,
I don't mean just go without doing your research.
Yeah,
but you have a responsibility to vote.
That's what I mean. You have a responsibility to be informed and participate in the process. Because I don't believe that everybody should just go vote. I think you have a responsibility to be involved in understanding who's out there, what's out there. Because it may not be that either one of them meet your, you know, criteria, moral criteria or political criteria or whatever. So the right to vote is also the right not to vote, of course. So I don't think that everybody, you know, is supposed to go vote, but I do think that they're supposed to be involved in the process.
Pay attention.
And pay attention to what's going on. Right.
And you're paying attention right now to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed on newhavenindependent.org. And we have the Reverend Samuel Ross Lee here talking about the primary. You know, for me, watching the primary, I sort of saw an evolution in almost two aspects of a Marcus Packer campaign here. I mean, I think he was doing a public service. Whatever you say about his campaign, every incumbent needs a challenge. I remember John DeStefano, I covered him for 20 years as mayor. And during the campaign, he always was very bitter and angry about anyone ever ran against him. But afterwards, he'd always take a deep breath and say, I'm a better mayor because they ran against me and they raised good issues. And if they had good ideas, he would incorporate them. And Tony Hart, whatever you think about her, and some people think she's doing a great job, some people don't. There are real issues she needed to be challenged on.
Mm-hmm.
And also, people have a right to have different takes on those issues and then be able to be represented by that when they vote. So, for instance, sanctuary cities. So Tony Hart's position in favor of sanctuary city policy completely, no matter what, even if we're defunded by the Trump administration, mm-hmm. is very popular in New Haven.
Right.
And that's her position. There are people who don't like that position, and Marcus Packer offered a nuanced position that if you liked it, you would say it was more intelligent and thoughtful, saying, I like the general concept. I want to see his decision. And at first he said, I'll go down and talk to the Trump administration, try to work it out. Mm-hmm. He got creamed for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of backpedaled a little bit and people had a little hard time understanding the position. I think it ended up saying, I'm for sanctuary cities. I'm going to stand for him. I'm not going to make nice Trump administration, but I still want to see I want it to come before my desk before I make any decision. There's a difference between a $500,000 grant the city might not get and a $5 million grant for law enforcement.
Right.
So I just think whether you think that he was just trying to get the votes of people who were against the policy without sacrificing those who was being a politician, or if you're saying he was trying to have a nuanced discussion, either way, he brought the issue up and he took his time to run for office about it. On gentrification, it was a very nuanced issue. You know, people can't afford the rent. Everyone agrees with that. Tony Hart believes that building on vacant lots, market rate apartments, brings us tax revenue and will lower other rents at other places in town that exist because their tenants go there. Marcus Packer says that's trickle-down economics. It doesn't work. And I think that people are not getting represented enough in housing policy. He did not give specifics of a single project he would or would not have approved, unlike Harp. He didn't give a specific of whether he would have continued the policy of seeking 30% affordable housing as part of a condition for any development that needs regulatory approval for market rate. But he still gave voice to people he heard campaigning who were dissatisfied with the affordable housing issue and made that very clear. And the gentrification issue is nuanced and important. And I just think we're better off for having that campaign.
Yes. You know, when I was a sophomore in college at Morehouse, it was actually my first year there because I was a transfer student, but I was a sophomore by credit or whatever. We had a guy run for president of the Student Government Association. Now, I had transferred to Morehouse from Howard University with some military time in between. The campaign for the president of HUSA, as it was called, the Howard University Student Association, was fierce. I mean, you had people running around with 10-point plans, and they were sliding them on your door, whole 9 yards. And I get to Morehouse, and this is one guy running for SGA president. I'm like, what is this?
Student Government Association.
Right, Student Government Association. And I'm like, what, you know, that? So that was just, you know, foreign to me. It was just weird. And so we had this guy who's a sophomore who decided that he was going to run against the guy. The claim was, in recent history, no one had ever run as a sophomore and served as a junior as president. It's always been, you run as a junior, you're a senior as president. And I got on his team because I thought the guy was going to win who was running, the junior, but I didn't think he should be, you know, running without challenge. That everybody should just step aside and just let him, you know, walk in the office. And so the sophomore guy ran. They tried some shenanigans after he actually won the election to get him thrown out, and tried to convene a student court or whatever. And we got him out of that situation. And it was good, you know, just for the guy to have, a challenger. He wasn't an incumbent, but he was a member of the incumbent's team. And in what he, you know, I think he served as a treasurer or whatever. The guy who ended up winning was probably the worst person in the history of the school. But the fact that somebody needed to just challenge the incumbent, and I think that's always an important thing. I also think it's important that, first-time candidates are careful about, you know, making promises and saying specifics on certain things that they don't have all the information for, because there's certain information that you don't have until you get in the office. And I think we're so, you know, we are spoiled by candidates on every level making promises about what they're going to do. You know, senators, when I get to Washington, you're one of 100 people. Shut up. You're not going to do that. You're going to, you know, negotiate with other people, and you might win, you might lose, whatever. But be realistic about what you're going to do. And candidates for the presidency, you don't know the whole story until you get there. So, you know, stop doing that. But to make those nuanced arguments is important. And I think people need to listen to those things as opposed to, this fundamentalistic view on a particular issue. You know, we're either in or out. I taught a class with the Aspiration for Higher Learning program. I've done it about 5-6 years, never in a row, but I've done it. And so this year I taught the contemporary issues class, and contemporary issues is not something you teach, something you use to teach something else, quite frankly. But one of the issues we discussed was sanctuary cities, and the students were, very interested in it. They were very, knowledgeable about it and that sort of thing. But their understanding of it was as sophisticated as many of the adults, which means that many of the adults' understanding of it is not sophisticated at all. These are high school kids. They were reading articles in the newspaper and that sort of thing. As they read more, they became more sophisticated in it. So I think, you know, we need to listen to these perspectives, these nuanced positions, and not just automatically, you know, jump on the, oh, that's flip-flopping, flip. No, the guy is making an argument. He's making a case for what he knows and what he doesn't know and what he says is, you know, practical and useful for the city, instead of just saying, you know, we're all in here. Now, you don't necessarily have to agree with him on that. But you also have to understand, like he's saying, if we lose a $50,000 grant, you know, maybe no problem. But what if we lose a $500,000 grant? What does that mean? Or $5 million, you know, from the federal government? What does that mean for the lives of the people who are supporting this? You might be okay with that and say, we'll take the sacrifice for our brothers and sisters.
Let's talk about it. Let's have it in the open.
Yeah. But at least be prepared for that so that if it happens and when it happens, now you're not running at the person who's in office and going, oh, you know, you made us lose this money. But yo, you voted for this. You supported me when I was saying this, and I was making this simple and to some degree simplistic argument to say we're going to support this no matter what. So I think it's a very good thing that not only that he ran, but that he raised these issues and he raised them in a nuanced way, because I think that's more honest than just jumping all in.
Do you think he should run? His name is on the ballot.
He's going to run, so it doesn't really matter what I think.
Well, he hasn't 100% decided. What do you think?
Oh, he hasn't.
He said he's leaning very strongly toward running.
Okay. I thought he was all in on that. I think he should. Yes.
What about the system now? We have sort of two elections. This has happened now since 2011, where there's a primary. In the past, there was a couple of times a bunch of people ran, then a second, but it's just Democrats who decide the first round, and now we're up to 14,000. Independents in a city with about, and they're about 37,000 Democrats, 2,000 and change Republicans. We have this two-step election now where you get two bites at the apple.
Mm-hmm.
John DeStefano suggested that we follow other cities and get rid of party primaries because you didn't get to vote in that first round.
Right.
So the Democrats got to decide who would be in the second round. So you might not have had a chance to consider Mayor Harp if she had not won
right
in this first round.
Right.
And then on top of that, it's so hard to petition your way onto the Democratic ballot, but so easy to get on the general election ballot, which seems a little backwards to me, if I could throw an opinion in there, because you had only 2 weeks to get 1,850 valid signatures on petitions to be on the Democratic ballot, and we saw in a bunch of races those ballot petitions were a mess. But then you need only something like 120 or 180 to get just for the whole city in the
right.
general.
Right. Yeah, I think the process is I did read that in the Independent, and John DeStefano said it's one of the most intelligent things I've ever heard John DeStefano say that I agree with which I agree. And I think it's, you know, and, you know, the proportional voting thing that, you know, three-fifths talks about.
Yeah, I'm with three-fifths on
yeah,
that one.
I wish you'd learn how to use quotation marks. But other than that, I you know, agree more heartily with that. Those notions about how to do this thing differently and better than what we're doing now.
Yeah. So you would like a nonpartisan primary so that you would have had a chance to do right. round one.
Right.
And then
just me, you know, personally, but anybody who's, you know,
the 14,000 unaffiliated voters.
Right. Exactly.
And then a round two would be the two leading. It's actually what happened in 2011, 2013. There were four people in Democratic primary. Jeff Kariki's emerged as the strongest challenger to Stefano. Two of them went at it. 2013, we had four candidates for mayor, and then the strongest two were Elliker.
But that only occurs if you have several Democratic, folk running.
Yeah,
and then plays out that particular way. What? But didn't Kirk Karikas?
Yeah, it was 2011.
Didn't he run as an independent as
I'm
well?
I'm saying in both cases, the second place person in the Democratic primary ran as an independent.
Right, right,
in the fall.
Right. Yeah,
that seems to be the new.
Yeah, that shouldn't be necessary, is what the other process would say. You know, everybody runs, the two highest vote getters, you know, if no one gets 50%, you know, run again against one another, against each other. So that's a better process, I think, than the one that we have now.
Yeah, okay, so that's good. And you are listening now on Dateline New Haven, WNHH Radio. Our guest is the Reverend Samuel Ross Lee, one of the most insightful and humane commenters on the political scene in New Haven. And he's talking with us about this week's Democratic Party primary. One other aspect of primary that struck me, Rev, was that Marcus Packer mounted a challenge. He did not have a team of alders with us. So until the very modern, until this century, when people ran for office within the Democratic Party or in a general election, they generally got a bunch of alders to run with them.
Mm-hmm.
We called them aldermen and alderwomen back then.
Right.
And they would, you'd have out of 30 wards, 10, 15, 20, 30 alder candidates aligned with a mayoral candidate. And they would stand for an idea. It isn't just about the personality of the candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that voters would be electing a team to sort of enact policy. Now, I can understand why Marcus Packer might look at it and say, if I run anywhere for alder, I'll be worse off. Because the Yale unions unite here, which is the most effective vote polling organization in the city, they have their team of people, and if they're challenged, they then pour a lot of people to ward against you.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's going to run again, that's how he lost his seat on the Board of Alders. He lost that sweep in 2011 by the Unite Here unions. So on the one hand, he was out there alone without a team and an army. On the other hand, do you think, I've noticed that when people complain about the machine, that's shorthand for an organization that has access to a lot of jobs and favors and money and puts people out there in their self-interest to work for you to elect candidates.
Mm.
But another way to look at machine is to look what Bernie Sanders did. He built the machine, but it wasn't based on jobs or money. He built people who shared a vision and went out at the very local level to work hard in precincts, and in some cases later elected some people like Josh Elliott here in Hamden. And then maybe people complain about the machine but don't feel their own machines, quote unquote, might have less of a reason to complain. Because it's easy to say, oh, the machine did it, but you can often beat them. There's a Wizard of Oz syndrome that these people you think are so mighty, they actually get scared. The Hart people were scared to death of Marcus Packer. They get so scared the slightest challenge. And then if you do the hard, there's the hard work of organizing that goes beyond just complaining about the machine, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. I think, but some of the complaints and some of the disdain about the machine is what the machine represents. And you're right. Instead of just complaining, people can try to counteract and should try to counteract. But I find there's a lot of apathy, not just, you know, in New Haven, in the American political system. And people have this kind of, you know, that's the way it is attitude. And that things cannot, you know, be different. Things cannot change. Or, you know, people are afraid to be, you know, that first one that goes through the door, that, you know, that pioneer goes through the door. That's the one that gets shot, right? So they're afraid of that, afraid of the consequences because they haven't seen any examples of people being successful in challenging and that sort of thing. And they've seen what happened when people are individualized and they go, you know, they speak up, they speak out, they disagree, they deign to disagree or they deign to ask questions about what the, you know, the machine, the system, whatever you want to call it, is doing. And they see those people get knocked down without recognizing that, well, if you were to join that, if you were to be a part of that, they can't knock all of you down. They can't, you know, you know, just destroy the whole thing. When people, you know, are looking at themselves individually and not as a community of people with a vision, with ideas and that sort of thing. And so I think people are frightened off because they don't, I don't know, they don't feel people that somebody's going to have their back when they go, or there's not going to, a lot of people going to have their back, or, you know, whatever it is. And then, of course, you still have the comfort of how the status quo might be working for you right now and that sort of thing, even if it's not working in the best it should be for the city, for the least of these, for the people who don't vote, the people who can't vote, like children and that sort of thing. They're not necessarily concerned about that because they're fine.
So what about, so I wasn't, without at all taking issue with your point about what this machine or a particular scene might represent, what about like looking at the civil rights movement? They kind of built a machine in the best sense of the word. It's so important that individuals have the freedom to voice what they think and they can inspire people. People, Michael Harrington can write The Other America, but it's going to take the civil rights movement to push Lyndon Johnson and the Congress to do voting rights legislation.
And the civil rights movement founded and, you know, bubble up from the black church. The bus boycott in Birmingham, Alabama was the brainchild, quite frankly. Well, not necessarily the brainchild, because it had been done before, I think in Louisiana. But the persons who started it in Montgomery were actually the Women's Political Action Movement. They started mimeographing flyers. King was put in front of this movement as the new person in town, who didn't have connections to the city fathers and, you know, wasn't in their pockets and that sort of thing. He was put in front of it. He just happened to be, you know, suitable for the situation as well. But 15% of the black church participated in that way in the civil rights movement. 15. Very small number.
That's what it takes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
15% is powerful.
It turned out to be, of course. But my point is that there were 85% sitting back going, we're not messing with that. We're not bothering that. We'll take the benefits after it happens, but we're not messing with that. And then afterwards, I had a friend, college classmate of mine, who worked Page or whatever it was he did in John Lewis's office. And so he was privy, he told me, to a meeting with some black politicians, former civil rights workers and lieutenants of Dr. King. And there was an issue that had been put on the table, moral issue, that was politically engaging, involved. And there was a particular politician who had the power, I guess it was, to participate in a certain kind of way. And he was going in the way that was, you know, opposite of the moral, you know, perspective. And they said, and he, my friend told me that someone said to him, "What do you think, you know, Martin would do?" To which the guy replied, "And you see what they did to him."
Yeah, but then you look at what 15% can make. If 15% of the registered voters in New Haven or in a party had a vision that isn't just about individual, but how they'd like the city to run, they could revolutionize the city. That's what Unite Here understood in 2011. They understood it was from organizing seats on the Board of Alders with an agenda. Started out youth centers, community policing, and jobs. And everyone, I've been critical of some of the way they operate. Sometimes I think it's not open and public. I don't always agree with their decision. I think they should have some kind of position on public education. Mm-hmm. But everyone's so down on them for organizing around a set of beliefs they had and challenging the power of Yale. And my feeling always has been, then they should organize something else. Michael Stratton briefly tried it with Take Back New Haven. And I think Tony Harp said this when they were against her on an issue. She said, "I'm glad they're out there. I want to have more people out there, whether or not they agree with me, rather than trying to criticize one group for being out there."
Right. You have to, I don't know, the psychology of people, the people's fears and concerns about, you know, daily life, daily living, daily reality. The creation of the black middle class in New Haven was largely done by the city government.
And United Church of Christ.
Huh? I'm sorry?
In United Church of Christ with the Board of Education.
Yeah, right. They may have been behind it, but what sustains it? You know, Edmonds, my Morehouse
Reverend
brother,
Edmonds, yeah.
is deceased. What sustains, you know, what they're where they are right now? And that's what they're looking at. That's what they're engaged with. I had people to leave my congregation for things that I said that were critical of the city government and the Board of Education, just because of what I said. Now, there's a lot of folk who, you know, look at pastors and particularly predominantly African-American churches and say, you know, you guys have power. Yeah, no, I don't. I have the power of persuasion, but nothing else. I don't run a government. I can't sign a document and make a policy. I can't fire, hire people. Right. But I can speak out. I can attempt to be, in the best use of the word, in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament sense of the word, be prophetic, you know, as it were. And people are afraid to be around that, just to be there, just to be in the presence.
Be made uncomfortable.
Yes.
So the one question I always face is, clergy people, how political do you get at the pulpit? Because if you and I are going to look at politics as intertwined with morality, how we treat the neediest in our society, how we resolve our differences over spreading of resources or opportunity. There's no question that, I mean, you and I would probably agree that political is a broader term than who's running for office and how uncomfortable does one make one's congregants. I guess, and this is one area I really agreed with Donald Trump. Donald Trump announced that he wanted to do away with the law that said, the IRS law, that if you're a tax-exempt congregation, you can't preach from the pulpit.
Right. I agree with that, too.
And Lyndon Johnson got that passed because nonprofit groups were against him when he was running, I believe, for the Senate from Texas. And I never quite understood how I always thought it's up to the congregation to do what some of your congregants did. A few of them says, "I'm not comfortable being challenged with this issue when I go to church," so they leave. Mm-hmm. And a bigger majority says, "This is a place I want to be. This is interesting."
Right. Well, I always thought it was a violation of the First Amendment, quite frankly. And I don't know.
Oh, I agree with you. I think that law is. Yeah.
I don't know how they got around that in their minds. Maybe they didn't. They just didn't care. But I still, you know, am uncomfortable with the whole notion of, you know, endorsing candidates and that sort of thing, because I do recognize a diversity of thought and opinions and that sort of thing within any congregation, first of all. And I don't want to suggest to them, you know, that, you know, I, you know, happen to like this person or not, that you should do that. And also to bring the notion of, you know, the specter of, you know, the voice of God is saying you should vote for candidate A or candidate B. So I'm still not doing that kind of thing. But I think The one thing I know that Donald Trump got right was doing that.
Because they should have the legal right to do it.
Exactly.
Then it's up to the congregant exactly. to decide. Like for me, I'd rather not have small capital P politics when I go. Mm-hmm. Like I happen to belong to a congregation which is, you know, probably voted about 120% for Obama. And, you know, all for same-sex marriage. I'm good for that. And I like we talk about issues like same-sex marriage. Mm. But it's important to me that the people don't have those views. I'm not talking about hateful views. But, like, mm-hmm. people who, like, Republicans, that even though there aren't many, it's really important to me that when they come in, they're comfortable being there, too, and they're not attacked for who they are. And while it's great to have challenging conversations about the important issues, small mm-hmm. P politics, mm-hmm. I think it's important that ministers have the right to preach from the pulpit whatever they want. And to tell
well,
you to
no, that
but
was
I,
never
if
the
I,
issue.
But if I make that decision, I don't
want to. Yeah, but the issue was not whether we could preach what we want to, because I'm not doing that. I mean, he's not going to tell me I can't preach what I want to. What he was saying was that we can't endorse. We right. can't be involved in partisan politics. You know, so we can be politically participants, but not, you know, politically partisan in that way, in those ways. And I think it's almost inevitable that small P politics is involved in the conversation, because once you start talking about the specific reality of the issues and whether or not they match up with our faith claims, you know, people are going to apply them to the reality of where they are and what's happening around them. You know, are we taking care of the least of these? Well, you know, how does that play out with our school system? How does that play out with our tax system? How does that play out with our housing system and that sort of thing? So, yeah, people are going to apply it whether you apply it or not. And I don't think it's I think it's impossible almost for it not to be involved. But it's not the same thing as saying, you know, vote for this person, don't vote for that person, you know, kind of thing.
And there's always a wink to it. So, like, you can so clearly make clear whom you want to have people vote for and get around
the rules. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I wonder sometimes whether that's sort of a way of disenfranchising the Black community, since that historically churches have been the main form of organization that challenged the status quo with the Civil Rights Movement, with the Underground Railroad, and that, you know, you look at these 527s and other big Koch brothers and other, even Soros, even though we might agree with his plans for things, his issues, statement, stances, they fund all these organizations that say they can't legally endorse a candidate, so they just do massive attack ads mm-hmm. on the candidate they don't like,
right.
or they just take coordinating either consciously or with a wink with candidates with a certain set of issues that they can use to drive home, like
right.
Swift voting and John Kerry. So why don't we just all open and say whatever you want and,
right.
and like,
right.
go wherever you want.
Or you know, you invite candidates, you know, to the congregation and to speak from the pulpit and that sort of thing. That's
yeah, how do you feel about that? You're not big on that, right?
I don't, not at all.
Because at Varick, I remember they brought everybody.
Huh? No, the forum at Varick.
No, I don't mean that. I meant like when Ella Koran for mayor, he got to speak there.
Oh yeah, okay. I don't do that at all. I was supposed to actually be a panelist on that forum/debate.
That was a good debate at Varick. The ministers, they asked fantastic questions.
Yeah, I think so.
Remember
well,
cousin,
you know,
I thought it was great.
Cousin is married to a Spelmanite. Is our sister school, so he couldn't help but ask good questions.
Yeah,
Bellamy is a Morehouse man, so he couldn't help but ask. Who else was on there?
I forget who the third was. Yeah,
I think Bellamy was there.
I want the minister's voice
because
in
I could
politics
be there.
In New Haven.
I thought from what I saw and heard of it and read of it, I thought it was a good forum. I thought it was a good engagement, and I think that's a good thing to do, necessary thing to do. I'm not going to bring in individual. You know, now what I have done and what I have allowed to happen was that if you came to the church, you can come out. You know, after our worship service, you can go down to the fellowship hall and engage whomever you want to, who want to talk to you there. I'm not disrupting my worship service for you to come and make.
And tell me why
statements.
You make that decision, because they don't. Not all churches and like. Right, our synagogue, we don't invite candidates to address. That's why we have the other form like you do downstairs or elsewhere.
Right.
Why do you make that decision? Why don't you want an office seeker to be addressing your congregation from the pulpit during a worship service?
First of all, that's not why we're there. second of all, I don't know if it's the second or third, but it was, you know what? While they don't say anything about it, a lot of the congregants hate that. And many, I have never had a congregant who told me that, you know, you need to bring them here. You need to let them here. Unless they were so intimately connected to that person that, you know, they wanted that type of thing to happen. I always got from them, I'm glad we don't do that at Emmanuel.
And
I'm glad we don't do that at Gill Creek Baptist Church when I was in South Carolina. I didn't do that there either. So it's not why we're there. We're there to, you know, participate in worship. Our focus is on that. It's not on, you know, the worldly powers, quite frankly, right now. It's on, you know, the universal powers as we see it. And it is, to me, it seems, you know, some sort of a tacit endorsement. Oftentimes it happens that way. We'll let, you know, this person come and not that person come. Sometimes people, you know, like you say, let everybody come. But it's just like, you got this captive audience. They came to church to worship, and all of a sudden up pops this politician. You know, you're extending the service, the worship service, for them to speak. And it's like, I didn't come here for this.
But you did come to WNHH Radio 103.5 FM to listen to Reverend Ross Lee join me, Paul Bass, to discussion about the political issues in New Haven right now. So when you have a worship service at Emmanuel Baptist, this is one of the leading churches in town, you didn't come there to hear politicians when you're doing your worship service. What are you up to at Emmanuel Baptist? What's the vision of where you want to take the congregation, how you want to be spending your time with them within the walls of the chapel and Day Street?
Yeah. The church, I try to remind my congregation all the time, does not exist for itself. We exist, you know, if we are, as Matthew declares, the light of the world, a light does not shine for itself. It shines to illuminate wherever it is. It's not there to illuminate itself or to illuminate for itself. If we are the salt of the earth, you know, salt doesn't exist for itself. Our responsibilities are for the least of these, to help, to minister to assist, to build in whatever way we can. We have lost a lot in the African American community since, I think, integration and integration in particular, and affirmative action in particular, in terms of our values, engagements with other cultures and other institutions and that sort of thing, has changed the values of the communities in a lot of ways. People began to move away from the community and that sort of thing, and left behind persons who did not have the advantages, you know, some of the advantages that they had. And now the community is very, very different. I grew up in a community as a foster kid and then as an adopted child. But particularly in my foster, you know, parents or my foster home situation, where I was only in one foster home from the age of 4 to the age of 11. A lot of kids get moved around. That one is more particular for me because my adopted home, we lived in a very rural place, Hamlet, where almost everybody was blood related. In my foster home, we lived in a regular neighborhood where people were neighbors. And in that situation, the children were taken care of by everybody. The older people were taken care of by everybody. We respected everybody. And next door to the house where I lived was a woman who, we didn't know the term at the time, she was an alcoholic. She was a single mother, had a son, alcoholic. We were not allowed to disrespect her, you know. She could say to us, you know, aren't you supposed to be home? And we couldn't say things like, you're not my mother. You know, we wouldn't get half of that sentence out before we were, you know, taken care of and then taken to her mother to be taken care of again. We were asked about our grades from strangers. You know, how are you doing in school? We had neighbors. I remember once we went on vacation, my foster parent, family and I. And someone broke into our house. Our neighbor across the street sat on our porch every night until we came home. That's the kind of community that we grew up in. And we don't have that anymore. We have this disconnection. We have this dog-eat-dog world all too often. And I think the church has a responsibility. My foster parents did not attend church. I attended church every Sunday. And it was understood that I didn't get in trouble in church because we were connected like that. They would come to the house. My teachers didn't send notes home if I got in trouble. They came to my house and said, Sammy, which is what they used to call me, and which is what I hate, You know, did so-and-so. We have lost that connection, and I think the church has a responsibility to try to bring it back.
How do we bring that back? Now, for instance, the church played a role in getting integration, a fact in America to some extent.
Right.
A role in affirmative action. Do we modify that approach, or do we build on it to try to bring back the values?
We bring back the values.
How do we do that?
You don't have to throw the baby away with the bathwater. Integration allowed certain things. It didn't mandate them. So I don't have to not go to Sandra's or Mama Mary's or whatever, you know, the soulful restaurant is because I now am allowed to go to a restaurant owned by, you know, people outside the community, some white persons or whatever. I don't have to not exchange money within my community because I'm allowed to buy stuff in other communities. I don't have to sign my kids up to, you know, the soccer teams that meet on Sunday morning because I'm allowed to, or integrated soccer teams because I'm allowed to, and keep them away from church or other activities like that. We were allowed certain things that we jumped into, you know, with both feet without doing the things that we needed to do to keep our kids grounded in a certain kind of way, to keep them connected in a certain kind of way, and to keep them matured in a certain kind of way, just because these other doors were opened up. The legal ability to participate in certain things were necessary because we were paying the taxes. We should have had, you know, better schools and have the same, you know, situations as the school system for other kids. Yes. But that doesn't mean that we have to leave our churches or leave our communities or leave, you know, our kids to other situations and that sort of thing without doing what we should do within our community.
With the church and with political organizing.
Right.
We can regain some of those values in a modern world.
Yes, and we should.
Without throwing out the gains that were made.
Right.
Reverend Samuel Ross Lee, it is always such an honor and a delight to talk with you about what's going on in New
Thank
Haven
you.
And what's going on in the world. Thank you so much for making time to be on Dateline New Haven today.
Thank you very much.
And thanks everybody else for listening to us on Dateline New Haven, WNHH Radio. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It'd Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.